Bimers，大家好，本期的 BYM 是我和孟岩还有嘉宾 Kevin Kelly 一起录制的。关于 Kevin Kelly，大家可能比较熟悉的是他之前的书《失控》，他同时还是连线杂志的创始人之一。Kevin 和亚洲有很深的渊源，他年轻的时候从大学辍学之后就背包在亚洲旅行了很久，并且拍摄了大量的照片，记录他的行程。在这次的 BYM 节目中，我们讨论了他的新书，这本书已经有了中译版，叫做《宝贵的人生建议》。书中收集的是 Kevin Kelly 给自己的孩子，以及他想象如果有机会能给年轻的自己给予的建议。除了这本书之外，我们还聊了他年轻的时候在亚洲的旅行，以及他的一部非常有趣但不太为人所知的作品，叫做《The Silver Cord》。这是一部兼具科幻和奇幻色彩的 graphic novel。故事的背景呢，是天使们羡慕人类的生活，而想采用一个捷径变成人的故事。节目的最后呢，我们聊到了 Douglas Hofstadter 以及人工智能。Hofstadter 是 GEB 的作者，他在人工智能方面的研究呢，对 Kevin Kelly 还有我呢都有很大的影响。节目的最后 ，Kevin Kelly 分享了为什么他对未来充满了乐观和期待。这次节目中的对话呢是用英语进行的。节目录制完之后，正好我跟孟岩之前也商量过，我们一起录一期播客。孟岩有自己的播客节目，叫做《无人知晓》。这次正好借着这个机会，我们录了一期节目。这个节目中呢，我们回顾了一下跟 Kevin Kelly 所覆盖的一些内容，以及我们自己的一些想法，会在以后的 BYM 播出。好，接下来就是我们跟 Kevin Kelly 录制的内容。
我总迷失方向，路上行人神色慌张，我内心冰凉。
Welcome to another episode of Blow Your Mind. Today we have a couple very distinguished guests. I have my friend Meng, with whom I wanted to do a podcast for a long time. But importantly, we have a very interesting guest, Mr. Kevin Kelly. Kevin is an author. His latest book is Excellent Advice for Living, Wisdom I Wish I'd Known Earlier. Our listeners are probably familiar with his earlier books, such as Out of Control, What Technology Wants, The Inevitable.Kevin wears many hats. He's a photographer. He's the executive editor of Wired Magazine. And he's also on the board of the Lang Now Foundation. Kevin, welcome to the show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for being open to whatever I have to say. And I really, really love this chance to be here in Shanghai, which I have not been for many, many years. I'm really looking forward to this. Thank you.
So your latest book, Excellent Advice for a Living. How did the book come about? What's the idea behind the book?
So the book is kind of described as about 500 sentences, little tweets, little Weibo's things that you send out, one sentence. So it's a very short book. I've collected interesting quotes all my life, and I really like the power that a little tiny tweet has. And kind of say it again and remind yourself and kind of unpack it.And at some point, I began writing my own quotes down as a way to help me remember them myself. So one of the little bits of advice in the book that I like to repeat to myself is when I get invited to go somewhere, to do a talk, to go to a dinner, to go for a walk with somebody that's out in the future, I always ask myself, okay, would I do this if it was tomorrow morning? Because it's easy to say yes to something that's 6 months out.Then it slowly comes up and it's the next morning. You say, I really don't want to do this. Well, I ask myself that now before I say yes. It's like, would I do this or want to do this if it was like in an hour from now or tomorrow morning? And if I can say yes to that, then I'm more inclined to say yes. I wrote that down and I'm going to repeat myself to this. And I realized some of this stuff is wisdom that I wish I'd known when I was younger. And I have three adult children and we have never given them much advice.I wasn't that kind of a parent, but I felt that, well, I should write these down for them because they should know about it when they're younger. So I wished I knew about them when I was younger. So I really began writing down things that I felt I wished I'd known when I was their age for them, for my three kids. And I did the first batch when I was 68. I did 68 of them on my birthday, and it kind of went viral.And I did another following year, another following year, and they all went viral. And so it was getting hard to kind of track them. So I decided to put them into a book that you'd hand to them. And that's the genesis of the book. It's a book of like the Bible without any stories. There's no stories. Most advice books are stories because stories are really a great way to tell some advice. But this is a book of advice with no stories, only the punchlines, only the takeaways, just the advice. That's the genesis of it. It's sort of things that I really wished I'd known when I was younger. A lot of the advice is sort of ancient. It's kind of like from the Bible, from Confucius, from the Stoics. It's been around. But I try to put them into my own words. And some of the advice is things that I know that I made up or I wrote for the first that aren't the ancients, like the one I just told you. I don't think the ancients talked about that, but... Mm-hmm. So there's a variety of different things. Some are very practical and some are a little bit more conceptual. And that is the mixture, which I like. There's no order to them. They're just kind of there to keep you interested and guessing. The idea is keep reading because you don't know what's next. The other thing is that they reflect my general telegraphic sense of writing. I write fairly telegraphically, really compressed. Even my longer books are just very dense because they're very compressed all along. And the three criteria that I had for anything in the book was simply that I really genuinely believe them, that I stood by them. This is honest. This is honestly what I believe and practice. Secondly, that they're short. And thirdly, that they could be useful. Not sarcastic or, just sort of like, are they useful? Are they helpful? So those are the three criteria that I used. Do I believe them? Are they short? Are they useful?
On the usefulness of these proverbs, the one of my favorite is if you're looking for something in your house and you couldn't find it, once you finally find it, put it where you first were looking for it.
Exactly.
That it works.
And I repeat that to myself all the time when I find something. It's like, okay, remember, put it back where I first looked
for
it.
That just totally makes sense.
Yeah.
Kevin, I have a question. The book's name is The Excellent Advice for Living.
Yeah.
There's a Chinese saying that, very, very famous saying that even we learn so many truths, so many advice, so many codes, we also strive for a hard living. Human need to learn from experience, learn from making mistakes,
right,
and learn from that. In my experience, people always found confirmation, not others, from the advice. So I just wondered, in your opinion, how can we learn from these advice?
Without having to make the mistakes?
Yeah.
One of the things I've noticed about the advice that I had given to me or looked for me is that there are several things about it is that the advice has to come at the right time in your life. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes some of this advice in the book will make no sense to you. You won't really think it's pertinent. There's no mistakes. But later on, it might. And so what I found is that you kind of want to be reminded, you want to try it again, you want to try it on like a hat. If it works, you keep it. If it doesn't, you try it on another one. So there's a sense in which these are very lightly, these are not commandments. They're not like commandments like you have to do this. Mm-hmm. This is like, try this way. And maybe you can... maybe it'll work for you. And if it doesn't, forget it or come back in 2 years and try it again. So it's very light in the sense of they're like tips rather than commandments. Here's a tip. Try this one. See if this works for you. Maybe it doesn't. Okay, but might later on, might in 2 years from now. Maybe it just doesn't suit you at all. But they're tips rather than commandments where you have to obey the thing.
In your title, you said... these are things that you wish you'd known when you were younger.
Mm-hmm.
If you can sort of a time machine, go back to your younger self, at which age would you give this book to
them? I think out of high school, right? Graduating high school. I think that's sort of what I had in mind. My kids are older than that, but that's sort of what I was imagining was when they were in high school. You're kind of old enough to begin to think about these things. You know, some of them deal with money, relationships a little bit. Ideas of success. I think that's really important. I think coming out of high school, you're kind of beginning, your world's big. You don't know very much. You may not be very wise. So that's what I would aim it for.
Nowadays in China's internet, young people don't like advice.
From old people especially.
Yeah, right. You don't live our life. So right. Don't give us your advice.
Right.
So
I think that's everywhere. It's not just in China.
Yeah, but I'm sure it's here. And what I would say to them is, okay, you're right, but check it out and see if one or two doesn't happen. For me, what I found over time is that even if there was two things that a book gave me, it made it worth. I that's all I expect from a book, mm-hmm. is to take away two things that might make a difference in my life, then that book is a success. This book has 500 of them. I think maybe two of them might work for you.
Some of the advice, I've known them for a long time, mm-hmm. even before I read your book, but I always struggled to put them into practice. Just right. A couple concrete examples. One is, don't worry. Like 99% of the things you worry about are not going to happen.
Right.
I know this is true.
Right.
I still can't help worrying. Another one, and I know I'm not alone in this.
Right.
Another one is, if you have a stupid question, just go ahead and ask it, because other people would have the same question. This is so true. And I think I first heard it when I was in high school. But it's just such a hard thing to do. At the moment, you're chicken out. What's your advice for people who totally agree with everything you said, but just have a hard time putting it to practice?
There are several things. There's meta advice about how to put advice into work. One thing is that you start small. You take baby steps. Maybe you put on your calendar, like, once a year, I'm going to just ask a question. Just once a year. That's all it is. And then you start that way. You do something once a year. You remind yourself. And even if you just put it in a journal and then you do it, I think you make habits that way just by starting really, really small and easy. There's a great book about changing habits called Atomic Habits by James Clear, and I highly recommend it. It's really good about trying to form a habit, which is what you're kind of suggesting. And I think just being reminded of it is another thing. I think, you know, if there are pieces of advice and you read it every couple of years and you go back and you're reminded of it, I think it really helps. Things kind of work at the inspirational level. Your subconscious is working on them. I think the power of subconscious is really, really incredible. And that's one of my pieces of advice, by the way, is that if you're working on a really hard problem, give yourself an assignment at night. Tell yourself, I'm going to think about this in the morning, I'll have a solution. And your subconscious is amazing because it will process things that you can't direct your brain to do. I don't know how that works, but giving your subconscious assignments during your sleep is very powerful. We run these scenario workshops. We're looking at trying the future, and we don't make predictions. You make different scenarios, and it's all very messy. The people are all, the first end of the first day is very dispiriting because it seems like nothing converging. Everything is crazy. But we always tell people, look at these, review it before you sleep, and in the morning, you'll have some clarity. And without fail, people come back and say, it's amazing. I see this thing here. So I would say, let your subconscious work on it. Be reminded. Try really tiny baby steps.
Two pieces of advice from the book. I find it fascinating. One is that if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Hang out and learn from people smarter than you.
Yeah. No. I'm in the right room right now.
Another, I think related advice. Only apply to jobs you're unqualified for.
Okay. Yes.
Now my question is, if carried to the extreme, certainly the first piece of advice, then no one would hang out with anyone because people only want to be with people smarter. So my question is, like, how do I convince someone who's smarter than I to spend time with me?
Right.
And how do I get that job that I'm qualified for?
So I don't know where in the order it is, but somewhere early in the book, there's another piece of advice that enthusiasm is worth 25 IQ points. One of the things I've noticed is that being enthusiastic will get you close to people who are very smart, smarter than you are. Enthusiasm is worth 25 IQ points. And so being enthusiastic about things, being, if there's someone that's smarter than you, they want to hang out with, having you may not be able to give them anything they didn't know, but that's not the most important thing in life. People want help in disseminating it. They want help in reflecting ideas. They want help in refining things. And so those all don't require necessarily IQ that's really high, require other kind of qualities. The people who accomplish most things in the world are not necessarily the smartest. So many other things that are required to get things done. And smart people, if they're really smart, understand that that's, they need things besides just intelligence. So they can welcome you if you are enthusiastic about what it is that they're working on, that you can bring commitment to it, that you are furthering the general agenda. I've seen that again and again where really smart people have other people around them that are not necessarily smarter than they are, but certainly as enthusiastic as they are. So that's what I would do. And here's something else, there's another piece of advice in the book, which is that the people who go furthest, in my estimation, are someone who is really good at communicating and a little bit smart can go further than someone who's really smart and can't communicate. And the thing about it is that it's much easier to change your skills of communication than your intelligence. And so that's another way to be surrounded by smart people, is that you are able to communicate what they know can't communicate. And the symbiosis kind of needed. And so there are lots of opportunities for things, because again, I think there's an overestimation of the power of IQ. IQ is just one of the things that we need in the world, and not the necessarily the one that trumps others, which is what a lot of the AI doomsters believe. And so you can bring many other qualities besides IQ that are valuable to people who have high IQs. Communication is just one example of that.
In the book, you didn't use the word IQ, but smart. People are smart in different ways.
Right.
I would even say someone who's very good at communication is smart in that
smart.
Particular
sure.
way.
Yeah. We ask intelligent, right?
Yeah, there's EQ, they call it, emotional intelligence and stuff. And so, yes, and so I think that's, I think we have a very, I think IQ is just a terribly wrong idea about intelligence.
Right.
There's a single dimension, multidimensional. We see that all the time. And animals have various levels of different kinds of cognition. And so it's a very complex thing. It's not a single, like, decibel. It's not like just one little dimension.
But in school, we are taught mostly the intelligence.
Right, exactly, right.
And so we need advice.
Yes, well, you need advice and you need context. And I think that's part of what I'm trying to say is, like, we tend to have these very narrow definitions of IQ. We have very narrow definitions of success.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of people's ideas of success is money and fame. Well, part of what I'm advocating is that you want to invent your own definition of success.
Yeah.
That's not someone else's movie. It's your movie. You want to have your own definition of what your success looks like. And it should not be just about the amount of money you have or fame.
Again, coming out of the book, don't measure your success by other people's
ruler.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because we're surrounded by people, particularly, you know, people who have lack of means and opportunity. They see a basketball star and a singer and a movie star and an influencer, and that's their definition. So they want to be them. But there's very little chance that they will be them. And at the same time, they're ignoring all the ways that they could be unique and different and successful. So this is, for me, the core of it. My advice book is, core principle is, don't try to be the best. Be the only.
Be the only. Be yourself.
Be a category of one. Work on something that people don't have a word for, what it is that you're doing. It's like you have to explain it to your mother. It takes you half an hour kind of explain to your mother what it is that you're doing. It's like weird and different. It's about you. It's just kind of your particular set of talents and experiences, which are different. And you're creating a definition of success that's works on for you. And it should not look like a movie star. There's only a few hundred people in the whole world that could be that. Don't even try it. Go in a different direction. And that's hard. Really, really, really hard. And the main thing, the hardest thing about it, is that most young people, including myself, have no idea what you're really good at and better than other people. You just don't know. that can be paralyzing. Like, where do I start? The answer is you start with anything and master it. You become master of something. You become expert at something. And it doesn't even matter what it is, because you're not going to stay there. That's just where you're starting. And where you're starting is nowhere near where you ended. And that's true of every hero that we can think of, from Steve Jobs to Leonardo da Vinci. It doesn't matter. They didn't end up where they started. And so where you start doesn't matter. But you want to start with expertise. You want to become expert at something, whether it's a programming language, you know, fashion design element, whatever it is. You want to become the best in that thing. And you're not going to stay there. You can use that as a platform to migrate where your interests are over time. It'll take all your life to get there, but that's as long as you'll be moving in that direction. So you don't have to understand where you're going to end. You just have to start by mastering something.
And if I'd really like to slip this in, that to get that job you aren't qualified for, I'd recommend join a startup or start your own company, yeah, or your own project. That's the way.
Right.
To, yeah, do something that you're, on paper, you're unqualified for.
That's what we did at Wired. And so we had five people who could not get a job anywhere. We were simply not qualified. So we started our own magazine, which was very, very successful. And we still, to this day, nobody would ever hire us, right? I mean, it was like, we're just unhirable because we weren't qualified. And so...
One second. I'd like to probe a little bit deeper. So you said you are unqualified. Unhirable. Unhirable. What exactly? Is it specific expertise or...
Well, so when
by
we...
By choice, you just don't want to work for a big corporation? Or?
Well, both. It's like if we went out to try to work for a magazine, none of us would have been hired, is what I'm saying. Mm. We didn't have the experience. I started... All five of us had started a magazine of our own before. We already started one magazine, which was... To me, the most qualifying thing was we'd all started a magazine before. Okay, I mean, one of the worst things to do is to have someone in the magazine business come and try to start something. It just doesn't work. Okay, we had started our own magazine, and so we had that experience of being an entrepreneur in magazine already. That was the main thing. But that doesn't.
Well, but on that point, if I were a hiring manager at some magazine, no, that would certainly impress
no,
me. Well,
no,
this one,
it doesn't.
This person has
no,
no. You know, has what it takes to do.
No, it isn't. It's because you're looking for the magazine already exists. What's the skill? You want someone who has 20 years of editing. You want someone who has reporting chops, whatever it is. We had none of those. Our only skill was starting a magazine. And so that's what we have to do. So, but then, we became experts later on, and I became a great editor and all that kind of stuff. And so I think you're absolutely right that you want to, that kind of playground of the empty lot of an entrepreneur or startup will allow you to find more what you're really suitable for, because you'll be doing everything in the beginning. You have to do everything. So you get to try everything and you get to see who you're suited for. So I think, yeah, that's great. But the risks, the likelihood of that startup succeeding is near zero. You just have to be
by
aware.
By default, zero.
You have to realize that the terrain, the regime, is that it's, you have to be willing to take that as a lesson. It's unlikely to survive very long by definition. So as long as you go in with that idea, then it's perfectly fine.
So Kevin, when you look back this experience, mainly it's a wire thing, how many things you own to the, maybe something like intelligence, smart, diligence, hard work, how many owns to maybe luck?
Luck is at least more than 50%.
More than 50%?
Yes, luck. Luck is incredibly important in this world. And the really rich people that I admire most are those who admit and recognize, talk about the role luck has played in life. From Jeff Bezos on, it's luck. But as you know, you can increase the surface area of how lucky you'll be by persistence. Like what happened, right? Persistence by trying stuff. So you can increase the surface area that luck has to work on by doing things, follow through, long term, trying again, not giving up, all those things increase the surface area of the luck. So you can prepare yourself to be lucky. That's what Awire was doing, was we were really committed to this and just trying to increase the surface area for the luck to happen.
I love this answer. You know, my last episode of my podcast is make miracles to happen.
Sure.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
This idea of having a surface area where luck can take hold.
Right.
My own sort of phrasing of it is the law of large numbers. So every little thing you try or large thing you try has a small percentage of succeeding. But if you try enough things, your chance of success approaches one.
Right, exactly. And that's, we're talking about habits before, that's one of the real great values of if you're a creator, a maker, is this idea of doing things on a consistently regular basis for that reason, which is that you have to have these large numbers. If you're a painter or a musician, an animator, you want to be doing things almost daily. And most of the stuff is not going to work. It's not going to be great. But the only way to get to the great stuff is to just a lot of other bad stuff, throwaway stuff. And there are several things that happen when you're doing it kind of on a consistent basis. One is you're producing these numbers, so you have a higher chance of connecting. Secondly, you make it a habit so you can overcome and get started so easy you can do it. The more you do it, the more automatic it becomes. And thirdly, there's more of a chance that you're going to find your particular thing in that repetition. But finally, it helps you to be generous because you can give things away because you understand that it'll come back tomorrow, that tomorrow there's more of it, that there's more of it there. One of the things that you get from doing things on a regular basis is you realize that there's plenty more down there in the well. You don't have to be precious about it. It's not like, well, this is the only idea I have. No. I know this from doing this every day, that I can just turn around and get more of this. So I am happy to give this away. I'm happy to share it with you. I'm happy to let go of it. I'm happy to kill it because it's not good enough, because I know from having to do this that there's more behind me that I haven't gotten to yet. So that practice of doing this on a regular basis is so, so important. And that's true of like whether you're an inventor, inventing things. I know inventors who they like to make something new every day. They're gonna invent something. And so it's true for whatever it is that you're doing.
Quite a number of the advice in the book are about learning.
Yeah.
Here's one of my favorite, because I was a math major, so this one really hits home. Learning probability and statistics is far more useful than learning algebra and calculus.
I have no idea why they don't teach that. It's just baffles me.
Where did this one come from? What experience did lead you to
this is my own experience. When have I ever used calculus in my life? No way. When have I need statistics all the time? Hmm. It's like why don't we teach that?
It's like law of large numbers, you know, an intuitive understanding of it.
No, I mean, I think it's just not examined. Algebra is kind of fun. You can kind of understand it, but it's still probability and statistics are the thing that you should be teaching in high school. It's so fundamental to everything we do today and calculus is like, it's just not, it's for physics majors, you know.
Follow-up question is, there's a lot happening in technology, very noticeably on AI, but also on other things. What's your advice for someone who has more of a liberal, like arts major, say?
Yeah.
How do someone who doesn't have a STEM field background
follow
what's happening?
The main venue that I suggest is simply to use it as much as possible. There's a guy, Ethan Mullick, who I think is a business professor at Wharton, who decided very early on to kind of like use the AIs and use them in class and have his students use them. And every day they're trying things with it. And he basically knows more about, he's now the world's expert on these. Even though he didn't invent them, he's just by the fact that he's using them in a very push the envelope kind of a way every day. And so you don't have to know any math. You don't have to know any kind of recursive stuff. If you just get the ChatGPT and use it and press it, try to see where it can go, you'll know, you'll be in the 1% of the experts in terms of your knowledge about that. I really preach embracing technologies and deciding what they are by using them. Thinking about them only take us so far. I call it thinkism. Is that for most of these complex things, thinking will only take us a little way. Only way we figure out what they're good for, what they're bad for, is through use. And if you are someone who can use them, you'll be ahead of everybody else just by using them. And in this case, it's very cheap to use and it's wide open. And I'm telling you, if you decided to explore the limits of the ChatGPT that which you can get today, you could become world's expert in the coming year. I mean, I literally mean that. You'd be giving talks about it if you explored it really hard, taking it to the limits, trying all kinds of weird stuff. You'd be the expert. No one else has done that.
One of my observations is that for people who don't like who's playing with ChatGPT,
yeah,
but don't understand what's going on behind,
yeah,
it, they might assign qualities to it,
yeah,
that is really not there, right?
I haven't seen that happen. I haven't seen anybody using it who's doing that. People assigning qualities.
The Eliza effect.
That happens the very first time. By the 100th time that you're doing it, you're not doing it. You're not appropriating the Eliza effect. Very, very quickly, you begin to see what the limits are. I would say after 25, the people who are assigning that are people who have tried it once and they're making stuff up. It's not the people using it every day. Nobody that I know who's using it every day is assigning it abilities that it doesn't have. You very quickly come up, see the limits of it by using it every day, literally for a year. You will not be assigning it. You'll be the opposite direction.
Another sort of limitation on that approach is that if you don't have the tech know-how to actually tweak the models, it just feels very limiting. Like the interface that's presented to you is just well packaged. You can sort of lift the hood and see what's underneath
it.
That's
true. Yeah. That's true.
And right now, it does seem that all the more interesting advances are happening with the fine tuning, with the training of your own models, with the hardware being so cheap, everyone can have their own models.
Mm-hmm.
So the people who don't have the technical know-how, are they being left out?
Yeah, they may be left out of creating it. But they can still, as I was suggesting, they can still be in a very important contributor to it because they might be communicating. We just talked about value of communication. There's a guy I know, Ken Bai, who took upon himself maybe 3 years ago to start doing interviews and podcasts with people in VR and AR. But he decided to interview everybody, anybody who was working on it. He didn't have to be a CEO, some star. He was like, he'd go to the VR conferences and just like walk around and interview, what are you contributing? What's your, and have them explain it. And he became the guy that was explaining it to everybody else. And
because you have talked to everyone.
Because he had talked to everybody. And that, and within a year or two, he became the world's expert on AR and VR because he had talked to everybody. Everybody was talking to him. He was explaining it. He was not a technical person himself. Mm-hmm. He was just a guy with a microphone walking around saying, tell me what you're working on and asking the stupid questions. I don't understand that. Can you explain that? So he became a necessary part of the ecosystem that even the experts were relying on, because you can't be expert on everything. You need to have people explain stuff that you're not working on. So there's a role for the non-technical person to be an expert on this. And yes, maybe you can't participate in actually inventing it, but there's so many other things you can be involved in doing. And when those other things that are being worked on finally are released, are useful, then you can begin to use them. You can be some of the first using them, discover all kinds of things. And this is the Uber message or the meta message behind it, is that the people who are inventing these don't actually know
how it's going to be used.
How they're going to be used.
Exactly. Yes.
What they're good for, what they're bad for. And you can be the person telling us what those are, because they themselves don't even know.
Yeah, when I was playing with ChatGPT, I felt like, well, I'm not exactly sure sort of the language interface is the best interface for this.
Mm-hmm. It's not.
like not for an artist, you know.
Yeah, yeah, so here's the thing: I'm doing this art every day, you know, with the journey and Dolly and all that kind of stuff. And here's something I discovered about that, which is that every day I post some art, but I was becoming frustrated because there were certain images that I wanted to make that I just couldn't get the models to make. And then I finally realized, I get it. They're never going to be able to make these because these are images, there's no language for it. You can't describe this in language. And so they are translanguaged. And so there's a whole bunch of possible images that are not tethered to language. And therefore, they're never going to be able to create those. And so it's like, aha, I get it. You know, there's a limit to what these language, because a lot of art has no language to describe it. And these models aren't going to be able to get you there.
Right. And also, I'd like to add that at a high enough level, actually, the math or the tech behind it's not, it's still hard, but it's not impossible to understand. Put in some work and get a very high level grasp of what's happening, statistical prediction.
Right. Understands, maybe not the right word, because I think that a lot of this is inherently ununderstandable.
It's a very alien technology.
Very alien, and you know, there are emergences. A lot of this is emergent qualities that you need to have that aren't present in a thousand connections or a million connections or 100 million. You need billions of them. And it's impossible. The idea of assigning a causal things are really hard in that high dimensional world. Causes aren't linear. They're kind of like fields.
It's a different kind of physics.
It's like fields, causes. So anyway, I think we're going to have to get used to the fact that there's things that are happening here that we simply are not going to understand. Just like we don't understand our own thinking in any respects.
I remember you ever mentioned in your one of your book that only humans care about math and logic, right? Mm-hmm. The universe doesn't care about that.
Well, it's a real question about whether we discovered math or invented. And mm-hmm. I think, again, high dimensional things, those are equivalent processes, discovery and invention. You could say that Benjamin Franklin invented electricity, and that you discover calculus or invent it. Yeah, so I think they're the same.
Slight side note, but I was reading rereading Richard Hemming's The Art of Doing Science and Engineering, and he made the case of our intuition of high dimensional space just so, like, we have no intuition at all.
Right. Right.
Whereas all of these models are happening at like super high, hyper-dimensional spaces. Yeah. So high-dimensional sphere, almost all the mass is on the surface. It's really blew my mind. I mean, another theme that occurs again and again in your book is the idea of traveling. Mm. Here's one that I really like. To have a great trip, head toward an interest rather than a place. Mm-hmm. Travel to passions rather than destinations. And also, on your homepage at kk.org, you said that instead of going to university, I went to Asia.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the best decisions I ever made.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
So why was that such a good decision?
I had no forethought. I mean, it was completely sort of accidental. Lucky, if you want to have it. When I came to Asia first in 1972, probably before you were born, I went to Hong Kong and Taiwan and then later Japan. I had never been out of New England. I had never eaten Chinese food. I never held chopsticks. I just was complete blank. And yet I arrived in Asia where there was this very deep, rich, alien culture to me that was visible inside out. There was a different sense of privacy, and most of the work was being done on the street. See what was happening. Walk into people's farmsteads unannounced, and they would welcome me. It was like an open university. And every time I came, every day, I was learning things and having my mind changed. That was sort of became my university in a sense. And
you spent a year doing this?
A decade.
A decade in Asia.
Yeah. And yes.
Okay.
And so it was cheap. Relative to me. So I could have very menial jobs in the U.S. and travel for a year, for a couple of months and travel for a year. And so there was this asymmetry, this arbitrage of wealth and privilege that I had. so I could go into Asia and for very cheaply be educated about how things actually worked in the world. And this was just at the beginning when places like in Japan were making all the things of the world. That's, you know, for China, that's who was doing it. And I could see them being made and I could see how things were happening. And it was just like, it was like going to university, graduate school, all in one. And I tell myself that I came back and awarded myself an honorary degree in Asian studies from that time. And I was photographing at the same time, which was my own assignment. So I was doing things. I wasn't just partying. I was actually making stuff. But that was always an excuse to get somewhere else to see something else, photograph it. And it was particularly valuable for me, again, because of the time I was going. I had two things going on. One was I was able to witness the past, like a time machine, for very cheap. The past, before then, you would need a lot of wealth to get an expedition to go into these remote places. I was just at the flux where there were jeeps and beat up buses that were going into. So for the price of a couple dollars, I could get there and sleep on in a government bungalow or something, someone's home. So I was exploring this thing where there's very remote cultures that were intact from modern times that I got to witness. And at the same time, the cities of Asia, they were building the future. Brand new cities like Shenzhen, building the new vision of the future at the same time. And that was like the best university I could possibly have imagined.
I mean, traveling is just a great thing to do for all ages.
Yes.
But do you think it's particularly important for young people, for youth?
So important. I believe, and I've been trying to get that we should subsidize it on a national level. We should subsidize. I believe in mandatory national service for 2 years. Some countries have that. But part of that 2 year would be like going abroad, the Peace Corps. If you want 2 years, you can go to the military, go work in the doctors, you can work in the Peace Corps, go abroad. We'll pay for it. Doesn't matter. And I think that the benefit of sending kids overseas for 2 years be so powerful for the country. It's hard to be at war with people that you know. It'd also be able to mixing people, taking them out of their bubble. In San Francisco, we live in a bubble. You know, it's very wealthy. Go, force kids go to live in Senegal somewhere. They have a, see what the rest of the world's like. Anyway, so I think it's so, so valuable that I think we should subsidize it for 2 years.
On a small scale, something like that's happening. When I was in college age, I actually traveled in the opposite direction from you. So I went to your home state for college. When I was a college senior, I learned about this fellowship. It's called for some of you listening, this might be relevant, called the Watson Fellowship. And it's given to college seniors. They give you a stipend. It's not a lot of money. I think maybe it's $20,000 at the time, might be a little more now. So enough to live on the condition that for the next year, the year after you graduate from college, you cannot stay in your home country or any country where you have lived for more than a year.
Wow.
So you have to go to a foreign country and you cannot return unless it's like a medical emergency.
Sure.
You have to write a proposal and they give you this money.
Wow.
The Watson Foundation. And at the end of it, you'll come back, give a report.
Wow, that's fantastic. Yeah. Did you get that?
I did. This is one of my life regrets is that I didn't. I actually had a proposal where I talked to my seniors, alumni who did it. And he told me about, you know, the thing he took away was he would wake up in a foreign country. There's no one telling him what to do. And he realized he's entirely responsible for what he get out of that day.
Yeah.
And that's immense freedom and responsibility and the fear of the unknown and the excitement at the same time.
Yeah.
And that's for 365 days.
Wow.
That was like one of the best experiences he ever had. So I had a proposal where I was going to redo the Silk Road.
Mm.
The Silk Road originated from China, but, you know, went through.
Sure.
But I'm going to do the part that's outside of China.
So right.
Like do it on land or by walking.
Oh, cool. That would have been great.
That would have been great.
You can still do it.
Yes, I can still do it.
Cool.
Yeah. Except I'm not 22 anymore.
How old are you?
Past 40 now.
Okay. Not too late.
But it would be such an, like, to do it, I mean, to do it at 40 would be wonderful.
Yeah.
But to do it at 22, 21, yeah, that would be
transformative.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's a great thing. I didn't know about that myself. And I'll have to relay that on. It's called the Watson Fellowship. It sounds fantastic.
It started by one of the IBM founders, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I could be wrong about that. But they give out, maybe a dozen scholarships every year.
Yeah. There are a lot of scholarships like that we know nothing about. People forget that. That's always my advice, by the way, for people who are applying to either elite schools, whether they be high schools or colleges, which is if you can't afford it, still apply anyway. Once you're accepted, there'll be people helping you try and make it work. So don't apply because you think you can't afford it.
Very true. Let's speak of college. You dropped off college.
Right.
Do you advise young people to drop off?
Yeah. So I have 3 kids who went through very intense schooling. They went to a bilingual school. They went to very high college prep. And the one place where my wife and I disagree a little bit is in education. She's much more career.
Tiger mom.
And I told the kids, you don't actually have to go to college, but you have to have something. If you have a project or, you know, like a trip somewhere, you have to have some structure to it, something you're going to do, and we'll support it fully. Give you all the support to do it. But if you don't have anything, then you have to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
So they went to college. That's not what I would have done. I just wanted to do a project. But they couldn't think of something that they wanted to do, so they went to college and no regrets. And so my counsel is for those who are really self-motivated and you have alternatives to things that you want to do, you should pursue that. And if not, then you should look at college. And the one thing I would say about college, my one piece of advice is that once you get into college, don't ever think about grades. Grades don't matter in college. No one will ever ask you for your college grades.
Unless you go to grad school.
What college is about is exploring and trying stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like the thing for grades are over. And I dissuaded my wife from getting a PhD, and it was the smartest thing that we did. She works in a place with only PhDs. She works for 23andMe now and worked for Genentech for 30 years. And they all call her a doctor, but she gained so far by not getting her PhD, just starting to work. And she had friends who were still struggling with PhDs years and postdocs. And was like, come on, you've been working already for 10 years and had a good salary and stuff. And so I think you have to be careful about PhDs and things like that. It has to really make a difference. I actually think people should graduate from school, go out into the work field, work for a few years, and then return to get a PhD or postdoc if it really warrants it, is what I would say.
So go to college or drop off from school are also advices, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I have a question again about the advice. So many pieces of advice, I mean, are ambiguous.
Yeah.
They are both, right? Both ways. In both ways. For example, Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett mm-hmm. ever suggest us, you know, I'm an investor. So they suggest us that you should focus on the forest, not mm-hmm. the trees, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's also advice that devil is in the details, mm-hmm. right? They are right. They are both right.
Mm-hmm.
So how can we learn from these advices? You know, these advices are also are always put into absolute words, right?
Sure.
So
they need to be absolute in order to be clear. But you're right. You know, it's like there's one bit of advice, which is forget the details, focus on the big picture.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Don't sweat the details.
Yes.
There's another piece of advice. It was the details matter. If you can't do the details, you can't do the big thing. Can they both be true? Yes, I think they can. I think they can both be true. Your life is made up of lots of details, and then you have a larger view. And so all it's saying is that you have to, in some ways, balance those. And there's no advice to you about your life in your particular circumstance that you're going to be able to, anybody will be able to tell you about how to make that balances. But I think if you are aware that you have to pay attention to strategy and not let the details work, and that you have to also focus on the details and forget the strategy, if you can keep those in mind at the same time, then that's what you, that's helpful to you. You actually have to have both of them, even though they contradict. There's a necessary contradiction that you have to pay attention, then you are going to figure out the balance of those.
So it's a subconscious field.
I think so. Mm-hmm. It's a paradox. Another paradox is that in order for you to be the only, to be the most unique person in the world, you actually need all the people around you to do that.
Right.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
You can't become truly yourself by yourself. So that's the paradox, is that for you to become unique, you need all of us to help you become unique.
Mm-hmm.
That's the paradox. You can't ignore everybody, but you have to ignore everybody
mm-hmm.
to become you. So there are a lot of paradoxes like that. And I think part of getting through life is understanding that both of those are going to be true at the same time.
I heard just saying that the sign of an educated person right. is who can hold
two
contradictory thoughts at
the same time. Yeah. And I think that's part of what it is. Mm-hmm. It's like there is what I call necessary paradoxes, necessary paradox of existence, of God. You know, all these things, they're paradoxical. They don't. Mm-hmm. And here's the other paradox, which is the most selfish thing that you can do is to be generous. That's the paradox. The paradox is that the more you give away, the more you're going to get.
Yes.
If everybody's giving away, how does that work? It doesn't add up. Well, that's the paradox.
Yes.
The most selfish thing you can do is to be as generous as possible. Mm-hmm. So the life is full of these kind of paradoxes. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's shifting gear a little bit. There's a work that you did that I just find fascinating, and it's mm-hmm. not as often talked about, which is a graphic novel
yeah.
called The Silver Cord.
Yeah.
I want to bring it up because in a different podcast, you once said that the book is the way it is. It's a short proverbs mm-hmm. because you're not good at storytelling.
Right.
But then the graphic novel.
Right.
Which is a story.
Yeah, yes.
So what gives?
So this is called The Silver Cord. It's a graphic novel that has almost 500 pages, and it was made with a group of people, including storytellers who worked at Pixar and other graphic artists who worked at ILM and Star Wars. And my role was primarily in the world building. So what I'm good at is building worlds rather than telling the stories.
Mm-hmm.
So I did work on the story, and the story is a lot me, but I worked with people who were much better and smarter than me in it to make it work. And I learned a lot. And I still think I'm not at the point where I would try and write a story myself. I still would work with other people who knew it. And there is a, I wouldn't call it a science, but there's a lot known about how to write great stories at this mm-hmm. point. Mm-hmm. People have really figured out. And each story is, it's not like there's a single individual formula, but there's a lot known.
You're talking about Joseph Campbell.
Joseph Campbell and beyond. Okay. People at Pixar and stuff they really know how to make a story.
So as a craft. That's the word I want.
Okay. It's a very high craft. And if I did it again, I would work with someone who knew more of that craft than I do. And my joy in it was not, I had more joy in the world building than I did in the actual dynamics of the story narrative. And I'm more comfortable in the world building. So I have an interest in fiction and telling stories. My role right now is working with people who are better than I am in the storytelling. And I would like to get better at it. I would like to get better at world building too. And so I think my talents suit world building a little bit more than the storytelling. But there's no doubt that storytelling is the most powerful way we have communicating. And the project I'm working on, the scenarios for 100-year future is about world building. It's building worlds, complete worlds on Earth, you know, the future. And that's what it is. And I'm building those words that other people, including me, would write stories in. That once the worlds are built, you could write lots of stories inside them.
What's the genesis of that project? How did it get started?
The Silver Court?
Silver Court.
So all the people who were involved went to this. We all went to the same church. And I had a picture in my head of the fact that our lives, if you can imagine our life here in your daily life and everything, that we kind of squander it. It's sort of like the ultimate VR world where we have all these senses. We can taste mangoes. We can have sex. We can run on the hill. We can see things. We can feel and touch. And that the image that I had was of angels who don't have bodies looking down on us and just feeling that we were squandering it. We didn't appreciate it. We're taking it for advantage. And they were like so envious to have our embodiment. Like, oh, if I could be down here and have a body, I would be doing this and I wouldn't be doing, I wouldn't be going to work, whatever it is. And so that was the picture. The picture was angels being envious of us and our embodiment and us squandering it. And so I imagined that my next step was to imagine these angels wanting to be embodied so much that they would come into robots. They would.
That
there was this imaginary line. In order to become a human, you had to go through a line as a spirit and get educated. Get moral orientation before you had a body, but that the angels would short circuit that and try to go into robots without being educated about the moral dimension. And that's the basis of the story. So it was like during a hymn we were singing about angels, and I thought, imagine the angels looking at us. They would just be so envious of our embodiment and being able to have all these senses and feelings and stuff, and they would just be so upset that we're wasting it. That was the genesis. So the graphic novel is about angels and robots. It's about robots that get ensouled from these angels illicitly, and they're kind of running amok. And there's a teenager who can travel between the realms. She understands what's happening, so she's trying to stop this ensoulment of this robot. It has quantum chips in it. And so that's what the story is about. What happens when a robot says they have a soul? What do we say to them and all that kind of stuff? And by the way, this book is available in Chinese. Did you know that?
Oh, I didn't know.
So wow. It was a Kickstarter program. They have a Chinese language edition of The Silver Cord.
I was just having a conversation with another friend the other day about this just recurring theme, certainly in the Chinese tradition, like sort of storytelling tradition, of both angels and, if it will, sort of animals wanting to be human, to have a soul, to have flesh.
Right.
So both angels and
animals. You know,
they would be animals. Envious of us. Animals who would like practice for tens of thousands of years just to have a human body and live a human life. But also in the Western tradition too, Pinocchio would be a prime example of that. Just fascinating why, maybe I can understand why animals want to be humans, but angels, like they already seem to have a pretty good life.
I changed my idea about angels. I think they have a horrible life. Nothing changes. They have no bodies. It's like, what are they going to do all day? Right. Well, you know, really? There's light? Just light? It's like, no. So they don't have to worry. So, yeah, but I think animals are kind of yearning for souls like that. You mentioned Pinocchio. A great movie is the movie by Spielberg called AI.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's Pinocchio.
The modern day Pinocchio.
It's a modern day Pinocchio story about the little AI boy, a robot boy, who believes and wants to believe that he's a human, wants to become a boy. It's really heartbreaking. So, I think that idea of, I talk about what technology wants. I also talk about what evolution wants. And one of the things that's clear through evolution again and again is that it makes minds many different, independently different, genres, classes, and families. So it made minds independently multiple times. It's like it wants minds. And I think it probably wants consciousness too, in the sense that if it keeps going, it'll happen more than once.
I do want to pick up on this sort of theme, where this is going later when we talk about AI. But sure. There's just one other thing about the Kickstarter project I want to mention. I did see the Kickstarter project for the volume 2 of the mm-hmm. graphic novel. First, I want to say, if I remember correctly, the volume 1 is you can freely read on your website. Is that mm-hmm. is that correct?
Yeah.
So definitely check it out. And I think you'll be, as I was, you'll be amazed at how it just looks a very polished, very,
mm-hmm. yeah.
just a one, like I was reading the PDF, so I didn't have the physical book
right.
in my hand, but I imagined it would be even more so.
It's big.
Having the, this both the size and so many pages and the graphics, they're just wonderful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Very
you.
Well done.
Thank you. Thank you.
I guess my question, sort of my, the thing I'm wondering is that, so the Kickstarter raised $40,000+, which is in respect, but it's not a huge amount.
Right,
of money.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
There were just half a dozen of you from what I gather. And you did it, I presume on this sort of as like almost like a weekend project. I mean, stretching over many years.
Sure. Yeah, 11 years.
But you did it pretty much on your spare time.
Yeah, right.
My question is, why we're not, like, it doesn't seem to cost a lot of money, not a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Like, why are we not seeing more of it?
Mm.
So on the one hand, we see mainstream sort of, let's say movies.
Getting
more bland, more sequel after sequel after sequel.
Right.
Well, we're sort of seeing a TV renaissance right now, mm-hmm. but like everyone wants to be Game of Thrones. But on the other hand, sort of making great artwork or literary work, it's so easy now, but we're not seeing more of.
Well, it's actually there. Comixology, there's a lot of it. You probably just don't see it, but there's a lot of graphic novels being made. They're not as monumental as we, and that was a mistake on our part. We shouldn't have gone, should have if it issued it in little packets. It's a better way to develop an audience, and also you can tell if you're connecting or not. But there is a lot of art. I think there will be even more art as we get into AI. And there are a lot of people experimenting, and we've been experimenting with using AI to generate some of that art. It's a lot of work. You can have an AI generate it. The problem so far is that AIs have very short attention spans. Mm-hmm. So if you want to make a long story and having the character continue, this one can't do that right now, mm-hmm. but it will. I think we're going to see this it's complete boom of people first doing graphic novels and then doing movies, right? So right now, novels and graphic novels can be done by one person in their bedroom. One person can make, you know, J.K. Rowling can write her novels and millions of people will read it, one person. Right now, to make any kind of a graphic novel and make any kind of a movie, it takes a team of people.
Mm. And a lot of money. Maybe not the graphic novel, but movies, yes.
Yeah, because the people, primarily.
Right.
Equipment is going cheaper and cheaper. We're going to get to the point, I'd say, within the lifetime of the people listening to this, where you'll be able to use AI to have a single person make a movie. Most of those movies will be terrible. Mm. They're going to be bad. But it's also going to enable some of the greatest movies ever because you have a single person, single crazy genius working on it. And it's going to be amazing. And it'll be primarily AI generated and, you know, with the scenes and stuff. And so I think this is going to be a phenomenal time as we move into making three-dimensional art, four-dimensional with time, you know, movies and video, and having that barrier lowered until one person or maybe just two or three at the most can actually make a feature-length movie. It's going to be amazing.
When that happens, because access to AI is cheap, like we have the same, access to the same AIs. So what would distinguish genius work from just mediocre work? It's just purely the idea, the thing.
I mean, that's, in fact, it's also true for AI itself. As AI becomes a commodity and it's like, what's going to distinguish one company? It's going to be the interface. It's going to be all those other things around any kind of good. General dynamics of AI are going to be pretty commodity-like as we go forward. No, there'll be lots of specialties, but those specialties are, again, they're going to specialize or they're going to have a better interface or they'll have a better wrapper or skins or they'll have a better platform. And so the thing about AI is my number one thing is we always want to talk about them in plural. There's multiple AIs. There'll be thousands of them, different varieties, different personalities, different specializations, different rules, different things we want to deal with it. So just think in plural terms. There's lots of them. And what distinguishes one from another would certainly be what they can do, but also how they look, and what the interface is, and what the protocols are. Mm. Is it Apple or is it Windows?
I'm just wondering how process of creating would be like. Because in our current medium, for someone like a painter, like you can paint in different mediums.
Right.
You can paintbrush or oil painting.
Right.
And the medium sort of give you this feedback, give you this resistance that really shapes the end work. Or if you're Shakespeare, you're writing English and the language pushes back.
Yeah.
But when all you have to work with is just AI and any idea you have, it just materializes.
Well,
what that medium feedback is going to be.
Right.
We're probably going to figure it out. I just find it fascinating.
So I would say, first of all, that we're never going to get to the point where anything you produce or anything you can imagine happens, because we already know that from AI, that it can't make everything. So there are going to be certain things that it doesn't do very well, doesn't like to do, doesn't want to do, can't do, whatever. But I think that process will be very much like a painter thing, like the way they make movies today. It's like painting. So the way that they make it is they have a storyboard, then they do a script and a storyboard, little pencil things, and then they do animonics where they make like a wireframe version of it. With it called scratch sound.
Almost like how Pixar is doing their work right now. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. They do scratch sound. Mm-hmm. So they get all the parts are moving around. They're very easy, simple, and they kind of move around. That works. And then they start to fill in various layers of, you know, the framing, the shaping. Then they do the lighting. You know, it's like they do sequence. It's like painting. You're adding layers and layers and layers and layers on top. And I think that's how the AI is going to do the same thing, where you have kind of a sketch, outline, do some rough blocking here, you're choreographing it, then you tell it to execute at various levels. So I think that's the process.
I can't wait to see that happen.
Yeah.
Or some people speculate that we're just going to feed our script to a machine and
spit
out a 2-hour movie.
It will do that. It will do that, but it just won't be very good.
Right. Yeah.
And for some people, that will be fine, or for some uses. That'll be kind of an average quick thing, but the really great stuff, the genius stuff, will be doing much more of this reiteration, constant shaping and reshaping, like any kind of art.
You probably do still want to have some finer control over not just handing everything to AI, because it's going to give you the average movie.
Exactly. An average movie is good for lots of things.
Right. All right, that would be a nice segue to the last thing I want to talk about, which is AI. I do want to introduce it by sort of frame it with Douglas Hofstadter recently wrote an article for The Atlantic. I know GEB is one of your the books that you really like.
And I was sending Doug examples of the early Midjourney, saying, look at this. This is like, you've got to change your mind here.
I'm sure he has, because
that's the point of the article.
And Hofstadter, by the way, is one of my very important intellectual influences.
Right.
So he wrote very recently. He wrote, and he doesn't write often. So when he writes, there must be something that really bothers him. He wrote for The Atlantic an article titled "Learn a Foreign Language Before It's Too Late." He makes the point that speaking language and learning foreign language.
This is not the article I thought. I'm sorry.
He wrote three articles.
Yeah, he wrote an article about him changing his mind, how the LLMs made him change his mind about AI. But go ahead.
Okay, but we want to hear about that article too. But this one, he makes the point that speaking language, learning a foreign language is so part of being human to have an appreciation of the human condition. Now, with very cheap large language models, you can translate everything sort of instantly. It's a reasonable translation. That people are just not going to learn foreign languages anymore.
Right.
So he ended with this paragraph, and I quote, "When we collectively abandon the age-old challenge of learning the language of other lands, when we relinquish that challenge to ultra-rapid machines that have no inner life of their own, but are able to give us fluent but fake facades in other languages, then we'll have lost a major part of what it is to be human and alive. So, and Hofstadter has changed his mind, I think.
Sure. And he wrote a whole book about translating, right. And the problems and the joys of translation.
Right. So is Hofstadter's worry well-founded? Yeah.
So in one sense, he's right, because I think we are coming up to the point where AI will do real-time translation that's as good as most human translators. So like right now, we could just be translating this in real time into Chinese. Mm-hmm. That would be an amazing thing. And I think we're really close to
that. We're already there. Yeah, almost there.
In the lab, you can kind of do it, but having it, you know, available and cheap, I think we're there. And I really foresee people wearing little AirPods that will allow them to walk around and have a conversation. And I think that would be transformative, because there would be people in China who are really, really good at something. They could now participate in the global economy. They could work remotely to Stripe in San Francisco because they've got the skills and they don't have to worry about the language skill. And I think it would just be incredibly powerful and transform the economy. Do we lose something from that? I think the number of people who actually like to translate and take joy in it is so small to begin with that they would remain for those who had some joy in translating. They're going to translate it differently than the machine. That's the thing. The machines are always alien. They aren't going to do it exactly like we do it. Part of the reason why we want them to do it. And I think there'll still be a small number of people who might enjoy that translation process, because there aren't that many to begin with. There's not that many people in the world who spend their Saturdays wanting to translate books from ancient French into English and or back. You strike me as very close to being bilingual. Are you going to miss this?
Reading and learning and speaking English, I've done it for decades now. I would miss that.
You would miss having to do it yourself. Like if you had if you had a little thing in your ear that did it, you might miss it.
I do very much appreciate what's happening with the language models.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there are books that are written in Italian and in German that I've been meaning to read, but mm-hmm. the translations were not available. But now I can read them.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But it's not just the language. It's all my school years, my travel, my friends.
Cultural. There's the language.
But the tool itself, I guess I probably miss it as much as like driving a stick drive.
I don't miss that at all.
Or just driving at all. Like, our children are going to grow up.
Right.
Just without learning how to drive.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting question. If you knew that you were never, ever going to drive again, how would you feel about that?
I'd miss it. But I'd only driving as like a hobby. Almost like I play tennis.
Yeah.
It's a fun thing. Or you're maneuvering a large vehicle and the sense of speed, a sense of freedom. But that might just be my upbringing.
It took me 2 hours to get from the airport.
On the lack thereof.
I had no sense of freedom whatsoever.
I just feel like learning to drive for my generation is so much associated with like being a teenager, but not all of a sudden you can just go out on your own and can go far places without having a parent chaperoning you. So it's a lot of cultural baggage. I suspect the younger generation would have it. Hence, they wouldn't have missed driving.
So like my kids were chauffeured for most of their lives around, taken to school, driven. And so like the idea of like being chauffeured for the rest of your life, that's what you get out of these. You're being chauffeured.
Right.
I think they're fine. They wouldn't miss it at all.
So even on the language, even though, you know, I myself love learning foreign languages. I still appreciate, I think we, humanity, you know, come out net ahead.
Yeah.
But on the larger point, so Hofstadter, this is probably the other article that you alluded to, turning pessimistic.
Yeah, he was pretty pessimistic about it. He was saying basically that his argument was that, look, these computer models, they can't do analogy. There's nothing there. As he said, there's no inner life. And then see what LLMs are doing. And anybody who looks at it can detect there's something happening.
Something there. Something happening. Something there, yeah.
Right? And so that something happening was shocking to him because he had really said that there's no way something could be happening. Mm-hmm. There's nothing there. And the thing about it is that it's the weird thing about it is that these models, basically, they imitate a human. They're imitating humans. It's like, what's the next likely word? But if you're just looking at a sentence, there's nothing that intelligent in a sentence. But if you look at a paragraph, look at a whole book, our intelligence is embodied into the book, into the argument, into the logic of a paragraph reflects some kind of intelligence. And if you can imitate that, then you're imitating intelligence. So there's this weird thing where the AIs are imitating genius so well that you're saying, well, they're just imitating it, but they're doing it perfectly. So what's the difference between
at some point you have
imitating
to
genius
them.
And being a genius?
Yeah.
Right? Like if you're an actor and you're going to imitate a genius and like you can answer any questions, like you remember everything in the world. How are you not a genius?
It's almost the original essence of the Turing test. So if you can imitate a person
right.
well enough that no one can tell, are you
right.
not a person?
Right.
Right.
So they're imitating the genius because the language, not just the language of a sentence, but the language of paragraphs and the language of a chapter in a book has embedded in it intelligence. That arrangement of the argument that they're making, the course that they take, is intelligent. And so they're imitating that at that level of a book. So they're imitating the genius that's in the book, and that's pretty good. It's not the best we can do or the only thing, but being the imitative genius. And so they're a perfect imitation of genius. And it's like, well, if you have a perfect imitation of genius, what else do you need?
I share Hofstadter's dread of, maybe we're losing some of our humanity. But also, I think you said at some point in a different interview that bottom up is going to get you quite far there, but not all the way. And you need some top down.
Right.
I think Hofstadter makes the same argument. Like, his research is very much going both directions.
Right. So what I would say is what we're finding out is that the bottom always is the best place to start. And it will take you further than you ever thought, but it's not going to take you all the way.
It's already taking us further than
And the question is, well, when will it stop? We don't know. But we know it's not going to go all the way. And so what I would say is that, it captures the intelligence in a book, but there's also other kinds of intelligences that it hasn't captured, not language. Language does encapsulate a lot of what we do, but not everything. So because these are language models, they're not going to get to the other things. They can do math pretty good, but can they invent math? We don't know. I don't feel that there's a threat to our humanity because I think these are artificial aliens, as I've said many times. These are like Spock, E.T. They're artificial. They think differently than us. And that's their main value, is because they think differently than us. So they're always detect that there's this alien intelligence, and there'll be many of them, and alien intelligences. And we'll use them for different things. But really the only way to make human intelligence is to have the substrate be, matter, a brain. You can't, if it's on the matter, the substrate, then intelligence runs on matters. That's the big controversial statement, which is that it can't just emulate. There's not a universal emulation of it because it matters in real time and that the substrate that you run an intelligence on matters. And if you have different substrates, you'll have slightly different intelligences. And so I'm not afraid of losing our soul to the AIs because they're aliens. They're artificial aliens. It's very clear that they have an alien weirdness about them and at their best. They can imitate an average human, but that's useful, tremendously useful. We want to go beyond that. Mm-hmm. They can become a kind of a really interesting alien. But I think we have plenty of room to become better at being a human. And my optimism is that they, the AIs, robots, will help us to become better humans, right? Because as we get them to do things, it's like having children. If you have children, you kind of become a better person because you want your children to be better than you, so you are kind of elevating them and elevating yourself at the same time. And I think as we try and, I mean, like, that's one of the things we know about the AIs right now is that they are kind of, they are like as sexist and racist and mean as the average human. And we're saying, we're not going to allow that. All right. We're not going to allow that. We want them to be better than the average human, which we can program them to do if we know what it is to be better. We don't know what that is. And so they're going to force us to imagine what a better human looks like. What does that mean? So we're going to have this conversation about what it means, because we're going to try to, we need to make our AIs better than us. What does that mean? So that's the conversation that we're having right now.
Yes. Well, first of all, exactly. Now we're having this powerful technology sort of create, bringing new beings into this world.
Right.
We have to ask ourselves, like, what kind of being we want, we want to create, and ask ourselves, like, how do we become better? I worry we get it wrong. Like, who's finally to decide, like, what better means? What's the definition of better? We haven't made the mistakes before. Who's to say where to do it right
this
time?
I think we're going to get it wrong, for sure. Right. But we have more than one chance.
We have?
Yeah. But that's what some people worry about. Like, with AI, maybe we only have one go at this.
No.
Maybe it'll destroy us, so right?
It's going to be utopia or doomsday.
That's going back to the overestimating the role of AI, intelligence.
Yeah.
Mm. Intelligence is not, it's only one thing you need to happen. So we have many chances. We're going to probably get it wrong the first time, but then we'll just make it better. And this question of who is we and who decides, that's the big problem. That's the thing we're going
to
work on.
We have to figure out.
We're going to figure out is who's going to decide this? What does it look like? And I think it's very likely that we'll have multiple answers. Mm. We'll have more than one kind of AI that is doing things.
We must do, I think.
That would be good to have more than one answer. So anyway, that's my very optimistic position, which is, we're not losing our humanity, that the AIs and robots are going to help us become better humans. That's their main job.
On which I think it's a great place to end this podcast.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin.
Sure, I enjoyed it. It was really a lot of fun. And you asked a couple of questions I haven't asked before, so I'm happy.
Next podcaster will have a harder job then.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, well, thank you very much.
You're very, very welcome.
Very fun.
我的脚已不再重要说一声你好紧张不得了 你的脸上写满了问号转身